From the syphilis capital of the world, ladies and gentlemen, it is Cardiology Corner!
With your host,
Dr.
Amol Mattoo.
Amol, the ESC just published a new set of guidelines for the management of acute ST elevation MI. And although I have not read the full 66 pages of this article, I know you have.
Yeah, it's good bedtime reading, most of it. There's a handful of pages that are very relevant to what we do in the emergency department that I guess we'll try to focus on. A lot of the other stuff is more for the cardiology folks.
So let's dive into that part. There are some true differences between what we see here and what we see in the AHA guidelines. And I thought we could focus a bit on about 4 or 5 pages of this document. So 4 or 5 out of 66 pages, not too much to take on. And again, this is what the emergency department is going to be focused on. I'm going to go through some of the big points, and I'm hoping that you can give your thoughts and wisdom on them. Sound good?
Sounds great. Yeah, let's go.
Point number one, a reduction in chest pain after nitroglycerin administration can be misleading and is not recommended as a diagnostic maneuver.
There's been literature out there for quite a few years indicating that although we love to give nitroglycerin and feel like if the patient's pain gets better, we've kind of got a slam dunk diagnosis of ACS at that point, it actually doesn't work out quite that way. In that some of the mimics of the ischemias, for example, esophageal spasm will oftentimes improve with nitroglycerin also. And then on the other hand, true cardiac ischemia is just as likely to not improve with nitroglycerin as the non-ACS conditions will not improve. So bottom line is that response to nitroglycerin is neither sensitive nor specific. Intuitively, I think it makes us all feel worse if the patient gets better with nitroglycerin, but it really should not be used as a diagnostic maneuver, just like we shouldn't be using Maalox as a diagnostic maneuver to rule out ACS and rule in reflux.
And actually, Amol, from your teaching, I get more worried when I see a patient, I'm like, wow, this sounds ischemic, and they don't get better with nitroglycerin. That really worries me.
Yeah, that's a great point. Those are patients that probably are going to end up needing, if it's true ischemia, those are patients that probably are going to qualify for emergent cath for intractable cardiac ischemia. You know, once again, if the patient gets better with nitrates, that's great. But if they don't get better with nitrate, your point is fantastic that you really still need to worry a lot.
Keep using nitro in ischemic chest pain. Don't rely on it diagnostically. Let's move on to point number two. They discussed the criteria for ST elevation MI diagnosis on ECG. And Amol, it's a bit more than just 1 millimeter of ST elevation in 2 contiguous leads.
While ST elevation in 2 contiguous leads should be concerning, it's a little bit different in leads V2 and V3 based on age and gender. In V2 and V3, in men that are under 40, you have to look for 2.5 millimeters. In men over 40, in V2 and V3, it's 2 millimeters. And then in women, in V2 and V3, it's 1.5 millimeters. So the criteria is actually a little bit different. And those criteria actually take into account the fact that a lot of patients have a little early repole or just some benign J-point elevation, typically in leads V2 and V3. Now, none of us are saying that you should ignore 1 millimeter of ST elevation, but it's not exactly just 1 millimeter everywhere the way we have always been taught and the way oftentimes the board review courses and the textbooks say. The formal internationally agreed upon definition is a little bit different in V2 and V3 based on age and also based on gender.
So if you see elevations in those leads and you have a concerning story, obviously you're still going to call your cardiologist and say, hey, I got a guy that I think is having an ST elevation MI. I know it's not quite criteria, but I'm worried. On the other hand, if you have a patient with a little bit of a nebulous story and you see ST elevations in V2, V3 that don't meet those guidelines, don't be surprised if your cardiologist says, you know what, let's get the troponin and a repeat EKG. Call me back. I'm not sure if I'm going to cap this guy. That should not be a surprising thing for us to hear.
Absolutely. And in fact, what may be just as important as the ST elevation magnitude is also the morphologies. You know, we all tend to be a bit more reassured when we see ST elevation that's concave upwards. So take a look at the morphology. If the ST elevation is oblique or straight, or if it's convex upwards, like a tombstone, then that should make you worry. And also if you notice that there is the presence of reciprocal ST depression in other leads in conjunction with mild ST elevation, then you really need to worry. So it's not just about the magnitude of ST elevation. It's also about looking at the morphology of the ST segments and also looking for reciprocal changes that really rules in or rules out the diagnosis.
Excellent. Let's move on to number three. Point number three is they mentioned Q waves on the ECG should not necessarily change the reperfusion strategy. Now, I'm a little bit unclear on why they mentioned this, Amal, so maybe you can clear it up.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point because still a lot of docs out there that are under the assumption that when you see Q waves, it's too late to do anything. And even now, people email me with these questions, and I've heard of cases where the patient has active chest pain and ongoing ST elevation, but there is big Q waves in the leads where there's ST elevation, and they'll call their interventional cardiologist, and the interventional cardiologist will say, nope, they've already queued out. It's too late. Just admit them, and we'll see them in the next day or two. And that's not right. And I'm so glad that these guidelines came right out and made that statement. Because if there's ongoing pain with ongoing ST elevation, what you should interpret that as is that there is still some myocardium that is still viable, which is actively infarcting. So there's still an opportunity to save some of that myocardium, even though Q waves have already developed. So don't just obviate your concerns just because there's Q waves that have developed also. It's a really, really important point.
All right. So more of a focus on the patient's symptoms, what the patient is presenting with, what is still going on with the patient, as opposed to just focusing on the EKG. And of course, we have to take all of these things together when we make these diagnoses, when we push for a cardiologist. Let's move to point number four. And point number four, Amal, looks at some of the additional leads that we can do on our EKG. And the question that we ask here is, should we routinely be doing additional leads to look for RVMI or posterior STEMI? And Amal, let me split it into two separate questions. You have a patient who has ischemic symptoms. The EKG shows some T-wave inversions, maybe an ST depression or two. The question there is, should we add these leads looking for an actual STEMI that is hidden that we're not seeing because of the leads that we have? And then the next question is, if the patient already has ST elevations, so I see elevations in 2, 3, and AVF, should I also be doing right-sided and posterior EKG leads?
I'll take the second question first. If you see evidence of an inferior wall STEMI, then you know that inferior STEMIs can, in about a third of cases, extend to the right ventricle, and in about a third of cases, extend to the posterior part of the heart. Remember, these are not the same parts of the heart. When I was in residency, I was under the impression that right ventricle and posterior STEMI are the same thing. They're not. They're two different areas. So why is this important? Well, if a patient has an inferior STEMI that's extending also to the right ventricle, how does that change your management? It means that you need to be very careful with nitrates if using them at all, because those patients are very preload dependent. If you knock out the right ventricle, the patient is very preload dependent. And if you give them preload reducing agents like nitrates, they can really bottom out their blood pressure. So if there's right ventricular involvement, generally we will not use nitrates, and instead we'll hang some IV fluids. And as long as their lungs remain clear, be aggressive with IV fluids, because that's the only way the patient's going to maintain their blood pressure until they get up to the cath lab. In terms of the posterior STEMI, if you already see that there's evidence of inferior STEMI, diagnosing concurrent posterior STEMI is not that important. And so I don't think that you need to do posterior leads if they have inferior STEMI also. The reason why the posterior STEMI issue is important is because about 4 or 5% of all STEMIs will be isolated posterior STEMIs. In other words, the patient's having a posterior STEMI, but there's nothing showing up in the inferior leads to help you out. It's just purely a posterior STEMI. And what you're going to see in those cases of an isolated posterior STEMI is, again, nothing in the inferior leads to help you, but there will be ST depression in leads V1, V2, V3. And so what the paper says and what general teaching is that if you see ST depression, V1, V2, maybe out to V3, those are patients that you should do posterior leads. And if there is ST elevation of at least a half millimeter, you've just diagnosed an isolated posterior STEMI. And those patients absolutely qualify for emergent reperfusion. In other words, give them lytics or send them to the cath lab right now. The literature has shown in emergency medicine, internal medicine, cardiology, we are bad at picking up posterior STEMIs, those left circumflex occlusions. Probably only about 30% of all posterior STEMIs make it to the cath lab within 90 minutes because they so often are misdiagnosed early on, which means if you don't know how to diagnose a posterior STEMI, you're already missing one out of every 20 STEMIs in your practice. And we can't do that. So the simple point here again is that if you see a patient with concerning symptoms who has ST depression in V1, V2, maybe V3, do the posterior leads. And if there's ST elevation in those posterior leads, call it a posterior STEMI. and get them to cath. It's such an important point to make.
And I think a lot of this, Amal, depends on, do you have PCI in your hospital or are you transferring? If I have PCI in-house, which I do in both the places that I work, I'm probably not doing the right-sided leads because that patient is getting whisked away to the cath lab so quickly, and any delay in that is going to be against what we should be doing to revascularize the patient. So I don't typically get the right-sided leads there. But overnight, Amal, sometimes my cardiologist is coming in from home. I've got 20, 30 minutes with that patient. And then, yeah, I want to do those right-sided leads because I'm going to be treating them actively for about 15, 20, 30 minutes. And if you're transferring them to another hospital, that might be an even longer period of time.
Absolutely. You don't want to delay if the patient can get to the cath lab right now. Not even a delay for one more EKG.
Bundle branch blocks.
All right, so the next couple of questions, Amal, focus on bundle branch blocks. Let's start with the left bundle. In the presence of a left bundle branch block, the ECG diagnosis of acute myocardial infarction is difficult, but often possible if marked ST segment abnormalities are present. And then they go on to embrace the Scarbosa criteria, stating that concordant ST segment elevation appears to be one of the best indicators of ongoing myocardial infarction with an occluded infarct artery. Here's the thing, Amal. We've talked in the past about the modified Scarbosa criteria that Steve Smith has created, and they don't mention that at all. Quick break in here. The Scarbosa and modified Scarbosa criteria are very visual. We're going to drop images of these in the show notes and list the criteria. The key difference between them is that Steve Smith dropped the third Scarbosa criteria because it doesn't perform very well, and he added a new third criteria. We discussed the modified Scarbosa criteria on EMA back in April 2016 with one of the authors of a study with Steve Smith, Dr. Salim Rezai. Check that out for all of the nitty-gritty on this topic. Amal posits that the reason the modified criteria isn't included in these guidelines is due to the absence of external validation of the criteria. So what's your take on this?
For those of you that know what the Steve Smith modified criteria are, I think they're extremely accurate, and I'm very confident that the validation studies are going to show that it really does work.
Pacemakers.
Let's talk about one other issue with the Scarbosa criteria, and that's with pacemakers.
Back in the 1990s, Elena Scarbosa, who's the cardiologist who came up with this, actually studied those criteria in pacemakers also and found that the Scarbosa criteria work pretty darn well in paced rhythms as well. Now, the problem here, and I think the reason why the Scarbosa criteria for left bundle and also especially Scarbosa criteria for pacers have not yet been included in the American guidelines is because all of those studies are really small. There simply are not large studies of patients with pacers having coronary occlusions. The European guidelines, however, have included this. So the Scarbosa criteria work very well with paced rhythms also. It was really nice to see that the Europeans were proactive, more proactive than the Americans, apparently, that they've actually included Scarbosa criteria for paced rhythms in their international guidelines already. So if you're in Europe, you can use these guidelines and use the Scarbosa criteria for paced rhythms.
The key there is don't throw your arms up. If a patient has a pacemaker, they're complaining of chest pain that you think is consistent with ACS, don't just look at the EKG and say, there's nothing I can do with this. Look for those Scarbosa criteria, because if you call your cardiologist and say, hey, I got this guy with a pacemaker. He has ST elevations that meet Scarbosa's criteria. I'm worried about his symptoms. Can you come see him? You're pretty likely to get the cardiologist down to see that patient, as opposed to calling him and saying, I got a guy with chest pain with a pacemaker. I don't know what the EKG says. It's useless to me. So I think even though we have not embraced these in the guidelines, we should be using those in real life for our patients that we see.
Absolutely.
All right, let's move on from the left bundle to the right bundle, Amal. Patients with MI and right bundle branch have a poor prognosis as well. It may be difficult to detect that transmural ischemia in these patients when they have chest pain because the right bundle can mask that. Therefore, a primary PCI strategy should be considered when persistent ischemic symptoms occur in the presence of a right bundle branch block.
I don't entirely agree with their take on the right bundle. First of all, they say a PCI strategy should be considered when persistent ischemic symptoms occur in the presence of right bundle. Well, the fact is, if you just get rid of the presence of right bundle from that statement, that meets the guidelines also. So in other words, it doesn't matter what the EKG shows, right bundle, left bundle, whatever. If the patient has pretty clear-cut ischemia and maybe something on the EKG going on, if you're throwing all your usual medical therapies, your aspirin and your heparin and your super aspirins and everything else, and you're not able to get the patient to be pain-free and get their EKG to normalize, you ought to be activating the cath lab in those scenarios, regardless of whether there's a bundle branch block pattern or not. But then specifically in terms of the right bundle, generally speaking, most of the literature that I've seen would indicate that if a patient with the right bundle is having an acute coronary occlusion, they actually do tend to show ST segment elevation. So all of your usual ST elevation criteria do apply pretty well for the right bundle. So I'm not sure I necessarily agree with their contention that right bundle really masks typical ischemia. I think you should normally still expect to see ischemic changes in patients with the right bundle. But again, going back to the main point here, if somebody has persistent ischemic symptoms, regardless of whether or not they have a right bundle, you should be activating the cath lab if you can't get them pain-free.
And those are in the AHA-ACC guidelines as well. Continuous ischemic symptoms in spite of maximal medical management, regardless of the EKG, should prompt consultation with a cardiologist for a cath.
Absolutely.
Recap.
Before we move on, let's sum up a bit of what Amal's already discussed. Response to nitrates can't be used to make a diagnosis in either direction. The absence of response doesn't mean it isn't cardiac, and the relief of pain doesn't mean it is. Don't be misled. In general, we're looking for 1 millimeter or more of ST elevation in anatomically contiguous leads, but remember that in the anterior leads, these numbers vary a bit. The presence of Q waves doesn't mean the patient can't benefit from emergency PCI. If they've got continued ischemic symptoms or ST elevations on the EKG, your cardiologist still needs to see that patient and take them for cath. Getting right-sided or posterior leads can be helpful, but don't delay transfer to cath if you've clearly got a STEMI on your hands. For left bundle branch blocks and paced rhythms, remember to employ your Scarbosa criteria and consider the modified Scarbosa from Steve Smith, which is even more sensitive and specific. All right, let's dive back in. Let's talk a little bit about early coronary occlusion. So some patients with acute coronary occlusion may have an initial ECG without ST segment elevation. Sometimes this is because they're very early in symptom onset when you're getting them. It's important to repeat the ECG or monitor for dynamic ST segment changes.
If your patient has concerning symptoms and the initial EKG is non-diagnostic, you've got to get another EKG. And the reason is that studies have shown that maybe as many as 20% of patients that have STEMIs are diagnosed with a STEMI based on the subsequent EKG. So if you're not repeating your EKGs, you may be missing as many as 20% of your potential STEMIs. So when the patient has concerning symptoms, get the repeat EKG.
Amal makes the point that sometimes it's hard to get 2 or 3 repeat EKGs in a short period of time because of how busy things are. A nice workaround for this is that in the patient you're really worried about, just leave the EKG machine on them and alleviate some of these struggles. It's the uncommon patient where you're going to be getting Q 15-minute 12 leads.
Right. This is definitely not meant for those patients that have squirrely chest pain and normal EKGs, but this is for patients that have a really good story. And just based on the story, you think, wow, this patient probably is having an MI. And then you get that first ECG and it is pretty unremarkable. Well, don't just obviate your concerns because of the EKG. If you have a concerning history, go back and get the repeat EKGs. Or if you're at the bedside right there, then sure, just leave the leads on and get a couple more EKGs over the next 15, 20 minutes or so.
The presence of ST depression greater than 1 millimeter in 8 or more surface leads coupled with ST segment elevation in AVR and or V1 suggests multivessel ischemia or left main obstruction.
Yes, so that is another point that we've talked about over the years here in the U.S., and it hasn't made it into the guidelines, so it was just heartwarming for me to see that they've incorporated this AVR issue into international European guidelines. I think a lot of folks, most folks in emergency medicine, have come to respect lead AVR. And the point here is that when a patient has concerning symptoms and you look at that 12 lead and you see ST depression in a bunch of leads, and now you look up there and lead AVR and AVR is elevated at least a millimeter or so, then what we've learned is that this is highly predictive of either left main coronary occlusion or triple vessel disease. Either way, that's a potentially really sick patient. And these European guidelines have now finally incorporated this into their guidelines as an indication for a primary PCI, in other words, activate the cath lab.
The US guidelines allude to this AVR elevation, but don't embrace the importance of this finding completely.
Let me just emphasize a couple of points with this regard, though. These are pretty sick patients. When we're talking about left main occlusion or triple vessel occlusion, we're talking about people that have a very large territory of myocardium involved. These are not patients that are sitting in the stretcher saying that they have 10 out of 10 pain while they're eating a turkey sandwich and flipping channels on the TV or texting other people. These are people that look pretty sick. They're oftentimes diaphoretic. They're oftentimes really in severe chest pain. And you'll just look at them and you know something bad is going on. So that's a key point. If a patient has any of these findings and they really don't look sick, I'd be a little skeptical about AVR or triple vessel. And I start thinking about some of the other things that can produce elevation in AVR. And there's quite a few other things that produce elevation in AVR. Bad LVH can do it. Severe anemia can do it. There's some other bad things like dissection or PE that can do it. There's some other not so bad things like extreme hypertension can do it. SVTs and tachydysrhythmias can do it. So there is a whole differential of things that produce elevation in AVR. But again, when your patient looks really sick and they've got multiple leads with depression, in addition to that elevation in AVR, you really need to worry about that patient. And in the European guidelines, they finally have incorporated that as an indication for primary PCI. I really hope that in the next US guidelines, they incorporated that as well.
There were a couple other things that Amal touched on in these guidelines in post-arrest management that we've discussed in the past. Amal and Rob discussed this in November 2015, and not much has changed. If they've got a STEMI post-arrest, they should go to PCI. If they don't have a clear STEMI, it's a little less clear of what we need to do with those patients. If their initial rhythm was VF or VT, think about ACS as a cause and get them to PCI. The guidelines also briefly touch on the use of opiates in ACS, and we discussed this with Brian Hayes back in March 2017, so go over and check that segment out. So a lot of good tips in here, and I'm sure that with the new AHA-ACC guidelines, when those come out, we'll see some of these newer things that are going to come over to those guidelines as well. So good to get a head start and look at these now. Amal, thanks a ton.
Thanks, Swami. I will talk to you later.